Hello and welcome, everyone. We are officially back. The Data Roll podcast is resuming. Today, we are officially kicking off the season number 2, and my today's guest is Pierre Lind, the founder and managing director of Nextio. Pierre, over to you for a quick introduction.
Oh, great to be here, Stanislav, and great to hear that you are continuing to the second season. I'm honored to be the first guest of your second season here. So excited to be here. I'm the co-founder, managing director of Nextio. I've been in the iGaming industry for a better part of 20 years. iGaming and events is the only thing that I know. It's the thing that I've been doing for my entire career. It's what I'm passionate about. It's what I live, what I breathe. So very, very excited for the conversation today.
Awesome. And you're actually anticipating, because my first question that I had on my mind, actually, how did you get started in this field? Because many people have like the different backgrounds. Some were playing poker in the dormitory, for example, and that's how they got involved. And how did you actually start, and what attracted you and brought you into this industry?
Oh my God, Stanislav, it depends on how far you want to go back, but we can start from the 26th of October 2006, because that was a very defining day for me that really cemented the fact that I was going to be in this industry for a long time. And it was a quite unconventional start to my journey, you could say. I founded what would become one of the biggest underground legally questionable poker clubs in Scandinavia when I was 17 years of age. And on the 26th of October 2006, in the middle of the poker boom, when the entire country of Sweden was playing poker at the time, the legal authorities decided to make an example of my poker club. So that night, we hosted a poker night of 150 people that had come from far and wide. And I organized this tournament. And in the middle of the night, massive police razzia with like 30 police officers storm up my poker club. I'm expecting some like a big Hells Angels type scenario. But it just turned out that it was, you know, some poker enthusiasts playing poker for a very modest amount of money for fun without any other, you know, alcohol or anything like that. It was just people, like we always used to call ourselves child care for grown-ups, basically. We were just some poker enthusiasts playing poker. And so the next day in Sweden, after this police razzia, because poker was so popular at the time in Sweden, I was on the front cover of all three national newspapers. And so that's how I started my career, you could say. Because of that, on the back of that, I was enacted into the Swedish Poker Federation that was fighting to legalize poker at the time and establish poker as a game of skill. That was kind of the strategy of the Swepof, it was called, Swedish Poker Federation. Because Sweden has a long history of poker. Actually, the Swedish Poker Championship is the oldest national championships in Europe. It's been organized ever since the 1960s, even. And so I was part of organizing the Swedish Poker Championships in 2006 and 2007 in Tallinn. And so poker was my love. I was one of the gamblers. I was the players. I was in and around the kind of gambling communities of the real and true kind of gambling segment of the industry in Sweden at that time for many, many years. I lived, I breathed the whole gambling experience. And that was kind of how my love for this industry was born. Because the way I navigated the gambling industry was really from a really positive point of view, where gambling and this form in poker really brought people together. And so, you know, my best friends at the time, you know, we were all poker players, and we would sit around a poker table for 12 hours straight, just talking about life, talking about everything and nothing, you know, 2-3 times a week through the nights. We weren't even drinking alcohol or anything. We were only playing poker and having a good time. And it really like exposes who you are as a person, I suppose. You know, you have players that are you know, really careful in how they play poker, and others who are really aggressive in how they play. And it really brings out a lot of emotions during those hours of play. And you get closer to people than what you would at a dinner table, let's say. So that's very much the backbone of why I have as much passion I have for the industry. I was very much in the gambling community in the 2000s. Yeah.
Okay, and first of all, I can imagine that this might be really a bonding experience. And at the same time, I'm wondering, so from Sweden to Malta and to global exposure, what was the path for you?
Yeah, I always knew that I would end up in Malta. because I was organizing and covering a lot of the poker tournaments in the 2000s. So I would travel a lot to the EPTs, to the WSOPs, to the WPTs at that time, and basically write about poker. So I was in charge of that time of Pro Sharks, as it was called, which was the biggest poker community in Sweden. So I ran that at the end of 2000. So I would travel a lot to the tournaments and cover those events. Some of those events happened in Malta. So I got the pleasure of visiting Malta a couple of times before I actually moved there. And I immediately fell in love with the island. And I knew that eventually I will end up in Malta. And it was just a matter of time. So I was eventually headhunted by Betsson at the time, or actually BetSafe, which was a separate company at the time, that hired me as a poker VIP manager. And it took me about half a minute to accept that job. And it took me 11 days to pack up my life and move everything that I had to Malta. And my second day at work, starting at BetSafe, when I've given up everything back in Sweden, the company got acquired, right? So it was Betsson Group that acquired BetSafe. And I had been offered a job in both of the companies. So I was offered poker VIP manager at both Betsson and BetSafe, and I chose BetSafe. So I was always making a joke that, you know, of course, now I chose BetSafe. So Betsson had no other choice other than to acquire BetSafe, of course, to get me over there. So I worked for Betsson Group for the next 2 years. I was in charge of all their hospitality in the company. So I took care of all the VIP players and organized kind of VIP experiences. And once again, I was very close to kind of the gamblers themselves, right? Because sometimes we get a bit distanced as an industry from our actual customers. There's not that many people in the industry who actually is in front of the customers, understands them, who can talk to them and to understand who they are and what makes them tick. Sometimes we see too many numbers, I think, in the industry. We look at numbers going up and down, but we don't actually think about the fact that there are human beings on the other side of the screen. And I think, again, I'm very grateful for my background of having been kind of had the opportunity to be with the playing segment for many years while growing my career in the industry.
This is great because it actually allowed you to really meet the players physically, and especially looking at where we are today. And back when you started, I think it was the time when the most popular phone was the Nokia 3310, I suppose.
3330, my friend. That's the only good Nokia that's ever been made.
Exactly. And well, the smartphones were not in use back then. So how has it changed, all of that, all of this environment? Not only in terms of numbers, trends, but also player behavior.
Well, I remember when we organized our poker tournaments in 2006, 2007, 2008, how online poker became more and more popular at that time. And some of the players, so like you would have technological shifts where this like mini laptop was out on the market at some point. And some of our players at the poker club, they would bring this like mini laptop and they would play online poker at the same time as they were playing at the tables, you know. And this was, of course, you know, before you were able to gamble on a mobile phone, as you point out. This was in around the time where the iPhone was born and, you know, people shifted over to the iPhone, especially in Sweden, quite quickly. But it would take quite a number of years before the industry actually caught up. And when I worked for Betsson Group in 2011 to 2013, this was around the time where LeoVegas was born. And LeoVegas were kind of the first, at least Nordic-based casinos that really understood the mobile-first approach, right? So they were kind of the ones who were leading the way into mobile. And we were like handicapped at Betsson at the time. We did not think about the mobile experience. We were adapted to the PC-first experience. Our systems were built as such. We didn't really think about technological changes and all of that. We kind of went beyond our day to just kick off to-do lists and stuff like that. But at some point, there was like a crisis meeting in Betsson. And I remember we are like, we are falling behind on mobile. Yeah, we have no idea. We have completely missed the fact that, you know, our customers want to enjoy our product in a different medium. And here we are with our pants and not ready for this shift, you know. And there was a lot of change in Betsson in general at that time. It was quite chaotic with the merger with BetSafe and so on. So Betsson really needed to do a sprint to catch up, you know. And that's why I think as an organization, it's so important to sometimes take, you know, more visionary led meetings and just discuss these like bigger trends, because Betsson were not ready for any platform change at that time. So yeah, so to your original question, Stanislav, I mean, the way we gambled in the 2000s on a static PC, you know, with the very few game providers that were available to us and the very rudimentary poker experiences that were offered at that time has massively changed. And I think one of the bigger changes perhaps is also the fact that the games are just much faster these days. People don't really have the patience to play like really slow multi-day poker tournaments anymore. You see like a lot of turbo and super turbo-like experiences, you say, even in the poker segment. So night and day, obviously, between then and now.
Which makes it tricky, especially for the legal operators who in certain jurisdictions have this 5-second delay of the spin, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the regulatory shift is there definitely for oftentimes, you know, regulators will kind of, let's say, hold back the fun and excitement from the gambling experience because in their minds, they feel that the gambler shouldn't get kind of caught up in the moment and stuck in these like time loops of hours that pass that feels like minutes, where after a session you played for many, many hours and it just feels like time flew by. But then on the other hand, you know, we have to also think about what the gambling experience is at its core. Why are we gambling so fun and taking the fun out of it? Is it the right way? I don't know. Like, should players and individuals have autonomy to take those choices themselves? You know, like, do we treat people like grown-ups that can take decisions, at least to some extent, without it going too far? I don't know. It's up for debate, I suppose.
And we already made the reference to Nokia. I remember that the keywords of Nokia was connecting people. Then I thought myself, it could be applying to yourself also. And then I thought, when it comes to connecting people, building those relationships in the iGaming industry, what do you think is the difference when it comes to building those long-lasting relationships, be it like in the B2B or in the B2C segment? How do you see that it's different? Because you certainly have friends working for other industries and there are differences. And what are your thoughts about this?
I don't know if the connecting people tagline is pretty good, actually. Does Nokia still use that? I don't know. I need to check.
Do they still exist?
Yeah, they do, actually. Nokia has made a comeback, believe it or not. They are more a tech company these days and still alive and well.
It used to be the first mainline.
Yeah, they are not a mobile phone company anymore because that technology, you know, obviously kind of crashed and burned, but they are making a comeback as a technology company these days. So it's more a B2B company, Nokia. But yeah, anyway, that's a discussion for another time. As it pertains to relationship building, this is, you know, my area of expertise these days, building Nekt.io. That's what we are trying to accomplish here, is connecting people, as you point out, and getting the right people in front of each other. And I have quite strong opinions on this front because I think networking is an area that people aren't really that educated in often, and they will jump into conferences with the mindset of the more people I meet, the better it is. And it's a very, let's say, intuitive way of thinking, because you would think that when you go to ICE, if you have more meetings, you'll do more business. Like, even some companies are targeting their staff on that very KPI. Like, how many meetings did you have? But I think I'm pretty sure about this, actually, that that is not the way to network and to do business. The way we have built our shows, for example, in Next Valletta, Next New York, is taking a bit of a different approach, where we want to kill the 15-minute meetings, as we say. We think that these impersonal 15-minute meetings that many people get stuck in at bigger shows like ICE are completely useless oftentimes, because what ends up happening is you have that 15-minute meeting, you're super stressed because you're already thinking about the next meeting and how far away is it, how do you get to that next meeting and all of this, looking at the time. So obviously you're not going to be very present. And what this leads to is you have to take notes. And then after the conference, the week after, you need to then follow up with a follow-up call to remind the person what you talked about and then move forward. So you can quickly see, why was that meeting valuable in the first place if I have to follow up and remind people of what we talked about? And for me, when you build relationships in person, it's much more important to establish yourself as a trustable person. Because if you are a trustable person, then people will want to be in your sphere. If people trust you, they will want to do business with you. If they like you, they will trust you and they will want to make business with you. So why don't you go to events, present yourself as a good person so that you can genuinely connect with people I mean, generally, not in these 15-minute meetings when you are already, in your mind, you're already at the next meeting. Establish those true relationships. Be consistent with those relationships. Because if you are presenting your way yourself nicely one day and then you present yourself in a not that great way at another event, let's say like you get too drunk or you show up hangover to meetings or these type of things, then your reputation will fall apart. You know, this is a reputation building industry. It's a very big industry, but it's still small enough for people to know who you are if you put yourself out there at events. So being consistent with your values and being consistent with your delivery is an absolute pivotal part of networking. It's also a longer term approach because you're not going to go into a meeting and sell your product then and there. It is much, much, much more about taking a medium to a long term approach and building that reputation over years, honestly. And I mean, I've been in industry long enough now for people to know that when they work with us as a company or me as a person, they can at least know and trust that I will do my best. And it's not about building a reputation of being Superman here. It's not what we're talking about. It is more about making people feel comfortable working with you. So have that as a goal, I would say, when you enter this industry and you start working on your reputation and who you are and who you want to be known as. It's much more important to be known as a person that people can rely on rather than positioning yourself as like the Jesus Christ of whatever your expertise is. Like, it's not really what people are looking for. People want to trust you so that they know that they can think about other things while you are doing the work that you are promised to do. And it's not really that difference between B2B and B2C, to be honest. When I did relationship building for my VIP players at Betsson, or when I hosted poker tournaments and I was with the players, it was the same thing. They just want to see that you're a good person and a genuine person and that you connect on their level. I think that's a personality trait also, that you need to be a little bit, on a B2C point of view especially, like you need to be a bit of a chameleon personality where like, you can connect with a lot of different personality types because you are connecting with people on their terms. You know, they are the customer. So you need to think about ways to make them feel comfortable, not the other way around, right? So that principle, I think, translates both B2B and B2C. We have a saying as a final point here in our company. I always tell my sales team that what is the best way to sell? You know, the best way to sell is to be a good person. So in other words, if you are a good person, the only thing you need to do is to be yourself. that's what we tell our sales team. Be yourself. Unless you are a serial killer, then don't be yourself, okay? But then you don't belong in our company. If you're a good person, just be yourself. And it's not that more complicated than that, to be honest.
Yeah, the serial killer will probably not have much employment, rather stay in the prison. And myself, as a person who converted from the retail industry to iGaming, I see one huge difference that I could easily tell between. In retail, the companies are much less attached to the vendors. And it seems to go along the lines of what you're saying, because what I saw, sometimes the biggest would cooperate with 5-6 different companies in the same area, sometimes collaborating, like taking three to collaborate, taking like breaking down one project into three pieces and getting three companies to collaborate in between. And in iGaming, I have the feeling that it's both harder to enter, but also harder to leave. And that's one specificity that comes to my mind. And a second one also is you need to speak the same language as your peers. And when you're in retail or wholesale, it's easier to relate. Everybody can have an opinion about, you know, going to the groceries, etc. Every single individual enters into a business relationship in a B2C mode. And in the iGaming, not only you have a specific target group, but you are also getting, even in this target group, the target group in the iGaming is getting more and more universal with the time, as we can see. But we're still not there yet. And we have so many stereotypes that surround. And this impacts how companies build their relations with their partners. I think it's a stabilizing factor in this kind of ever-changing business.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I would echo that too. I mean, there was Peter De Jory, who was the head of the Netherlands industry organization, NOGA. I will always remember when he told me in one of my earlier podcasts that, Pierre, the iGaming industry has no friends. And so we need to take care of each other. And I think what you mentioned earlier, that iGaming is more difficult to leave, is a little bit based on that we do live a bit in a bubble in the industry where we need to protect ourselves. And we are a bit different. We are on the fringes, from other industries. And we don't really cross-collaborate that much with other industries, which means that once you form a network working in this industry, you're likely going to build that network only within the industry, not with kind of cross-collaborating industries. So you tend to stay here for a longer time.
Yeah, and at the same time, some people say that for all those reasons that we have already mentioned, the industry might look as hermetic, sometimes lacking freshness or a new approach. And when I think to it, we have sometimes decision makers who grew up in the offline and maybe won't always follow and meet the needs for faster interaction and quick feedback, which is required by the new generations that are today the customers that are entering on the market. And what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the industry is quite young. So, you know, when I started at Betsson 2011, the industry had been there for, you know, 13, 14 years, maybe something like that. Everyone was doing really well, kind of by default. We were working with very rudimentary tools, and there wasn't really a supplier network at the time. And that is something that has been born throughout the 2010s in general, that we have a more vast supplier network. And I think where we are today, I think we will probably start seeing more resurgence of a more creative industry. The thing is, we have kind of like two parts of the industry, let's say the regulatory markets and the regulated operators that are beholden to very strict and difficult to navigate regulation, which essentially means that innovation has to take a backseat. And then you have the other side of the industry who are operating in pre-regulated markets, let's say, without those type of constraints, that are looking to innovate and do new things. And I'm seeing a lot of really interesting startups right now that are trying to do things differently. Even in a market like in North America, for example, where very quickly the market settled on these two massive incumbents in FanDuel and DraftKings, who just kind of like bought up all the market share. For a while there, it felt like this is just a market for the biggest of the biggest, and no one else will be able to enter this market unless you have, you know, $5 billion in marketing budget. But we are starting to see some interesting initiatives. Obviously, on the sweepstakes side of things, operators are entering a little bit from the side, you know, being creative, let's say, to enter the market. Same with arbitrage, the new entries that are propping up, like Crypto.com and Robinhood, but also from the regulator space with Betty, the common Canadian operator, who are entering the market targeting a female-led demographic. Because what they probably realized is that DraftKings and FanDuel are sports-led, right? They are first and foremost sports brand that are generally talking to a male demographic. And why not create a brand that is more targeted for females? And that's what Betty has done, and they've done really well on that front, you know. So I don't know if I want to agree with you where the industry is today, that it doesn't really produce that much interesting things. I think there are startups propping up left, right, and center. There are creative ways to enter new markets. But at the end of the day, you know, the fundamentals are very important still, and there are still iterative product as well in the industry that just aims to improve the sign up process by 0.3%, because if you are able to get 0.3% more players to sign up through your registration flow, if you translate that into millions of players, then of course that will generate a large amount of revenue for you. So that iterative process and focusing on the fundamentals is still a very important part of the industry as well.
Okay, and what are the trends that you see emerging beside the, for example, that you mentioned, the female targeting casinos and the crypto guys? What do you see as something that will quickly evolve over the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, what is, if we want to take a true helicopter view here, Stanislav, I think what the clear trend in the industry right now is that the industry is dividing itself into two. So we come from a dot-com background in the industry, right? And in the mid-2010s, the industry started to regulate locally, first in Europe, now in Latin America, North America. And the industry, at first, the operators were leaning towards the regulation. When Sweden regulated, for example, in 2016, the operators were quite excited over the fact that now regulation is coming and we can get clarity around how we can operate in these markets from a more long-term perspective. That excitement quickly dwindled into a realization that margins was gonna get squeezed, and it was going to be very difficult for medium and smaller operators to be able to be profitable in that environment. And so the industry then shifted again, where some operators decided that in order to survive, we have to move back to the dot-com environment. And today, where we are as an industry, is very much this divide where some operators are becoming highly regulated and they are leaning into the regulation. Those are usually the bigger operators. And then you have the other segment of the market, operators that are born into the dot-com environment, or legacy operators that are moving back into the dot-com environment with focusing on pre-regulated markets. But then you also have like another trend that is born out of that segment of those operators who are operating in the pre-regulated market, because the bigger they get, I think the less risk-averse or the more risk-averse they become more careful. Right. And so you see the likes of Stake, for example, that are born out of the world of crypto, you know, the true crypto poster operator, right, that was born out of the 2017 crypto boom, that at first operated fully in the crypto environment and that are now moving in towards the regulated environment, regulated in Colombia, Italy, Denmark, and other jurisdictions as well. And so you see this like new generation of operators that are now kind of moving back in towards regulation. And it seems to be one of those things where kind of the bigger certain operators become, they come to a point where you need to work with the regulators and so on and so forth. But I think that is the overall biggest trend of the industry right now. It's just that divide where like the more regulated operators becoming more regulated, the unregulated one becoming less regulated. And even I think the future trend will be also on the B2B side of things, where now you have regulators that are setting boundaries on the B2B providers. So game suppliers, for example, in certain markets are now not allowed to work with the unregulated operators anymore in order to service the regulated ones. And this is actually, I think, a good initiative by the regulators to thwart the efforts on the unregulated operators in order to give an advantage to the regulated ones. And I think a future trend now will be that we'll also see that divide happening in the B2B segment also, that some B2B suppliers will move in towards being regulated only, and other suppliers will move towards servicing the unregulated space.
Yes, and most probably within the pre-regulated markets, but I myself biased towards technology, so I'm curious to find out how much do you hear about personalization. We know that there's no one-size-fits-all approach, and how you hear people are addressing the need to personalize within targeting campaigns and so on.
Yeah, so I think there was an acceptance a few years back that being an operator is just a commoditized product. All operators are the same, with some small tweaks here and there in their UX UI, but by all accounts, they would be a commoditized product offering the same games, similar layouts, similar products, and so on and so forth. I think a trend that seems to start to happen now is that operators want to differentiate themselves. They want to, there are more and more visionary founders that are looking to create products that are a little bit different and targeting a bit different segment, let's say. And personalization, gamification is at the top of the agenda for operators that can afford to be creative and bring vision into their product in order to differentiate themselves. So I'm by no means an expert in the tech itself. I leave that to some of your more educated guests. But all I can say is that the conversations that I have within the industry, gamification and personalization, now also through the use of AI that is evolving rapidly, is at the absolute top of the agenda for a lot of the people that I talk to.
Yep. And from my side, what I see is that everything boils down to understanding who your players really are, even if it may sound very simple. Yeah. Just picture this, you use the advanced segmentation techniques, just to name a first example, and then suddenly it helps you to tell between clusters of players that even first sight, they look identical, but this happens when you look with the naked eye, and when you apply segmentation and clustering, suddenly you see that these you're able to tell between two different groups of people instead of one, and suddenly you can target them with specific campaigns because you see that there's something more to it instead of, hey, that's just a group of people between 18 and 25 who live in a specific hilly region in the mountains or whatever, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, I mean, we work with a company called Blask that is a good strategic partner to ours. And this is a market data analytics company. And they are kind of trying to open the hood of the industry, let's say, to show how big markets are compared to each other and how big the operators are within those markets compared with each other. So you can go into the market of Brazil, for example, and you can see all the, you know, 250 operators that are live. Who are they? And how big are they in comparison to each other? But one of the features they have launched is also customer profiling there, where they have conducted in some markets like India and Brazil, actual surveys with actual human beings of around 50,000 people in each market that are active gamblers. And they ask them questions like, what's your income? How old are you? What are your interests? And they are trying to create customer profile for these markets to then offer to the operator partners. And this is a great way to just break down the demographics in each market, compare them with each other to understand, you know, which games are going to be more popular or what will retain the players better in certain markets. You know, I speak a lot to David Nettarelli and the guys over at Spribe, for example, the leading crash game provider, and through Aviator, the most popular crash game by far in the world. And it's interesting to hear them talk because Aviator is, I mean, it has to be the most profitable game in the world at this point, like by far. It's insane how the volumes that they are producing through Aviator, you know. But some markets, Aviator is not interesting to the players. And in other markets, it's the most popular game there is, you know. And it's they attribute it often to like the culture of the players, where like in some cultures, superstition is a more kind of common thing amongst people. And in those markets, Aviator tends to be more popular because the players feel like they can influence and they can find patterns and they can find different gameplay and so on. So when you go on YouTube and you search Aviator, you search the game, then you'll see like hundreds or thousands of videos of players who are explaining different strategies how to play Aviator. And that speaks to a certain demographic, you know. So important to understand who those demographics are, right? And what markets that game will translate to. But obviously, there's just a million things you can do with that data.
So the game is rigged, and how to rig the game towards your favor, yeah?
yeah, you know, that's a very central part of gambling for a lot of people. We are pattern seeking machines, human beings. We like to find patterns, and Aviator, you have, you know, the control of stopping the game. It's that like tension between like keep going and take a risk for a bigger return, or stopping now and collect your winnings. It's a very delicate tension that causes a lot of anxiety and excitement at the same time. Like I'm super fascinated by the crash game genre and what Aviator have created, by the way. I mean, it is so different from playing a slot machine, where your brain kind of goes more into trance and like it relaxes you, whereas Aviator keeps you on your toes. And it creates anxiety and excitement at the same time. I don't know any other game that does this.
Wow. Yeah, I think I have to play a little more. So,
not for the faint of heart, that game, that's for sure.
Yeah, and just a kind of a wrapper, last question. So imagine for those looking to enter the iGaming industry, what advice would you give when it comes to the building relationships, branding, and a healthy, steady position in the market?
Despite the reputation that the industry has from an outside point of view, we are incredibly welcoming industry. I see this all the time at our events, where, you know, we have some like amazing story from our events where, you know, someone from outside of the industry come to visit New York. They will, like our event in New York, they will message us beforehand and say like, oh, I'm new to the industry. Can you help me to just get me started at the conference? And we are like, well, this is the easiest thing we can ever do, because when they come to our event, we will be like, okay, meet this person, meet that person and that person. And then boom, all of a sudden you have through those 3 people, you met another 20 people, and through those 20 people, you met the whole conference, you know? So it's such an easy industry to start building a network in. People are so curious. You know, we are an industry on the fringes, and that means that we have to be creative in order to thrive. We are experts in being creative as an industry. There's no other industry, because we are forced to be creative. And so what that means is that people are always very curious to understand what the new entries are, what the new companies are, what can I bring to the table, so on and so forth. So people will always welcome new people into the industry for that purpose. So I wouldn't overthink it too much if you are someone who are considering to kind of dabble your toes into the industry. It is incredibly straightforward to show up at an event and get the conversations going and get the network flowing. And yeah, I think you should know that it's an industry that is made up of a lot of good people, you know, on contrary belief to what a lot of outsiders think. It's a lot of good people in this industry, and we should be more proud of the good work that is happening in the industry for sure.
Exactly. Quite unlike the cliches. Wow. Thanks a lot, Pierre. That's going to be it for today. Guys, with Pierre, we've covered quite a few topics today, ranging from recent trends, history, development, and relationship building within the industry, as well as hot topics and others. So, Pierre, was great having you today with us.
Awesome, man. Thank you, Stanislav. Always good to be here, my friend.
Thanks a lot. So, time to sign off. And remember, keep rolling with the data.